I'm Jane Clayson in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The U.S. military says it has destroyed enemy defenses in one of the last safe havens for al-Qaeda in Iraq. Yesterday, U.S. warplanes dropped 40,000 pounds of bombs in a rural area southeast of Baghdad in one of the largest bombing campaigns of the war. U.S. officials are not sure yet how many insurgents were killed. 9 U.S. soldiers have died so far in a countrywide campaign that began this week. It's called Operation Phantom Phoenix. For the latest from Baghdad, we turn to Washington Post correspondent Amit Paley, who just returned from Diyala province, where he was embedded with U.S. troops. Amit, welcome. Good to have you.
Good to be with you.
Is there any way to determine yet if Operation Phantom Phoenix has been successful?
Well, it's very difficult to determine that since the operation just started, and we don't even know the full scope of the operation yet. And even for American commanders on the ground running the operation, it's difficult to know. I was just in Diyala province, which is northeast of Baghdad, and part of the operation there was designed to flush out al-Qaeda in Iraq from one of their largest known concentrations in the country, basically a mini-state of al-Qaeda in Iraq. When they moved in there, they found that al-Qaeda had either fled or had blended in with the population. So by one estimation, you might say that that is a failure and that they were not able to actually capture or kill al-Qaeda in Iraq. But by another measure, you might say that that was a success, that that area is now under the control of the American military, and they hope to set up the presence of the Iraqi government and Iraqi security forces there. So it sort of depends a bit on what your standards are, but at this point, we're still trying to determine exactly what has been going on and where al-Qaeda in Iraq is.
So what would be the next step then for the military if al-Qaeda fighters have fled or blended into the local population? What would they do next?
Well, right now in Diyala province, American forces are spending a lot of time trying to clear the area and trying to gather a lot of human intelligence on where these fighters were and where they might be right now. And that takes a long time, as American commanders on the ground acknowledge. It's very difficult to do that in a place where you don't know the culture, where people are very suspicious, where al-Qaeda has been for some time and has intimidated the local population. Many of them are afraid to speak with Americans or to give honest information. And all of that is, of course, greatly complicated by the fact that there are booby-trapped houses and cars, roadside bombs, one of which 2 days ago killed 6 American soldiers and one Iraqi translator. Right. In one of the deadliest attacks in recent months here in Iraq.
The area of this current military operation has been ravaged by war, as you well know, for years before this bombing campaign. Why is this place such a hotbed for conflict, Amit?
Well, there's just been a tremendous amount of civil strife here between different ethnic groups, between different countries, between Iraq and Iran, and between Saddam Hussein's security and intelligence services and the local populations. It was striking, though, to me when we went to some of these tiny, tiny villages in Diyala province. These people have been through a lot of strife, a lot of war, and many of them just seemed exhausted by it. They were obviously very afraid, but they expressed the common wish of most people in Iraq to just have security. But that's obviously very difficult for them when their area is passing back and forth between the control of different groups. At one moment, it's al-Qaeda in Iraq imposing Sharia law on them and curfews and forbidding women from wearing certain types of clothes or even men from smoking. And the next moment it switches to American hands with a totally different set of rules. The sentiment we got from talking to those villagers is they just want a return to normalcy and peace.
You talk about that return to normalcy. Broadly speaking, around Iraq, how would you describe that sense of security? Has it been returned in many of the other areas around Iraq?
Well, in Baghdad, where I am right now, there has certainly been a sense over recent months of an increased sense of security here. Levels of violence have indisputably been dropping since the American troop buildup began a year ago. But I don't think anyone should take that to mean that this is a safe or normal situation. We're talking about going from really horrific, almost unimaginable levels of violence to most Americans to simply very high levels of violence.
On a lighter note, much lighter note, tell us about the snow that fell in Baghdad this morning. Is it true?
There was a little bit of snow that fell this morning. It was a bit unexpected, and for a number of people who circle in and out of Iraq, and many of whom have only been here thus far during the summer when it gets up to 130 degrees and it's just oppressively hot. It was quite surprising to see snow this morning.
Amit Paley, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Amit Paley is a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post in Baghdad. Presidential politics is now focused on Michigan in Tuesday's primary. Republicans and Democrats go to the polls. We'll have more on that in a moment. But first, the big issue in Michigan, the economy. Job losses and foreclosures dominating the headlines. In Detroit, for example, the unemployment rate is more than 15%, and home foreclosures are now the fourth highest of any city in the nation. Jerry Goldberg is a lawyer in Detroit and an activist who's trying to do something about that. He and others are demanding that the governor declare a state of emergency and suspend all foreclosures in the state. They will also testify this afternoon at a special hearing of the Detroit City Council, where a task force is trying to keep people from losing their homes. Jerry, welcome. Good to have you.
Thank you for calling.
So give us an idea, Jerry, of what some of these neighborhoods look like, some of these neighborhoods that are affected by foreclosures in Detroit.
Well, just to give you a picture of the crisis, in metropolitan Detroit alone, 72,000 homes have gone into some kind of foreclosure in the last 2 years alone. And what we're finding is once the homes are in foreclosure, many of them become abandoned, they get boarded up. And we're in a city that's already been devastated over a number of years by the economic crisis brought on by the exodus of so many auto jobs. But it means that whole neighborhoods literally are being destroyed. Most mortgage companies view a 1% foreclosure rate as an extremely alarming rate. The foreclosure rate in Detroit is officially 10% and 17% in many neighborhoods. Mm.
So these neighborhoods are emptying out. Where are these people going?
Well, that's a good question. Where are people? I mean, Detroit's had a lot of exodus of population, but many of the people, and I've been in touch with many people, they have nowhere to go. Many of the people who are losing their homes are senior citizens who basically had their homes paid for, then got thrown into these predatory loans, get loans where their payments are almost higher than their monthly incomes are, and now where can they go? They can't afford rent. They can't afford anything. In Michigan, of course, it's coupled by the unprecedented job loss. Michigan has lost 336,000 jobs in the last 6 years. And these are industrial union jobs, paid decent wages. So we have a kind of a confluence of two crises. We have the subprime crisis on top of a massive economic crisis, the biggest job loss in Michigan since the Depression.
And so with that as a backdrop, you and others are demanding that the governor of Michigan declare a state of emergency and suspend all foreclosures in the state. Is that a real possibility?
It certainly is. There are two statutes in Michigan that mandate that the governor declare a state of emergency during periods of crisis, natural or man-made, and provide special powers to meet the crisis. What we are demanding is that the governor use her authority under the law to declare a state of emergency in Michigan and place an emergency moratorium to stop all foreclosures in Michigan. There's a precedent for this. During the 1930s, the state legislature in Michigan utilized its emergency powers to pass a mortgage moratorium act that essentially suspended foreclosures during the Depression for a period of 5 years. Mm.
And you're testifying this afternoon at a special hearing of the Detroit City Council. Are you essentially going to be laying out this argument today to them?
Yes, and we have a very supportive city council. What we're essentially going to be asking today is that the city council make a formal application to the governor to declare a state of emergency in the city of Detroit as part of the process of beginning this process toward a statewide moratorium. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be testifying. We're confident that they will make that application because of the crisis. But it is a statewide crisis. We got a call last night from a woman in Benton Harbor, Michigan, which is a very hard-hit city on the western edge of Michigan. She told me that 60% of the homes in Benton Harbor are in some kind of tax foreclosure. That doesn't even include the foreclosures by the financial institutions.
Jerry, just to wrap up here, give us an idea of what the ripple effect of all this is.
Well, the ripple effect, of course, is that when homes go into foreclosure in a neighborhood, it brings down the property values for the whole neighborhood. I live in what's considered a very stable neighborhood in Detroit, a working-class neighborhood called East English Village, one of the few integrated neighborhoods in the city. But now we're seeing in our neighborhood, vacant homes are popping up all over because of foreclosures. And what that means is the property values for the whole neighborhood go down.
And I'm thinking of crime, too.
Of course. We spoke with a woman last were trying to work with her to preserve her home, and she told us how two doors down, a home that they did a lot of work to refurbish the home, then the home got foreclosed, and it's been thoroughly vandalized. So all the social crises that stem from the economic devastation are certainly hitting Detroit, and have for a long time. Detroit is a city of homeowners. If you look at Detroit, you'll see it all over the city. There are people who own homes. It's not particularly an apartment city like many others. Yeah. I believe Boston is. It's a homeowner city, and traditionally people had their homes, and they would live in their homes their whole life and then pass them on to their children and have a secure retirement. But now these seniors are all losing their homes because they're members of these predatory loans. So this crisis is devastating. When you're talking about 10% of the homes going to foreclosure, and that's before the resets next year, what are you talking about? 10, 15, 20% of the people being thrown into almost some form of homelessness. It's an unprecedented emergency, and it demands emergency action. And we believe the only solution is an emergency moratorium to stop foreclosures that must be put into effect right now.
Jerry Goldberg, thanks so much for your time.
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling.
Jerry Goldberg is an attorney and an activist with the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War and Injustice. Up next, presidential politics.
I know that there's some people who think, as Senator McCain did, he said, you know, some jobs have left Michigan that are never coming back. I disagree.
One of the reasons why I won in New Hampshire is because I went there and told them the truth. There's some jobs that aren't coming back to Michigan. There's some jobs that won't come back here to South Carolina.
Candidates John McCain and Mitt Romney during last night's GOP debate in South Carolina. For more on the economy and how it's playing in the 2008 presidential race, we turn now to Nolan Finley, editorial page editor at the Detroit News. Welcome to you, Nolan. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
So Mitt Romney calls John McCain pessimistic. McCain says it's just straight talk. How are these competing messages resonating with voters in Michigan?
Well, they're both right. I mean, John McCain is right. The manufacturing jobs we've lost over the years aren't coming back to Michigan. But Mitt Romney's also right. If this state is going to have an economic turnaround, it will be on the back of the auto industry and the creation of high-tech research and development jobs, other jobs in this industry, high-skilled manufacturing. And that's what the economic development people in this state are out hustling. Mm.
Your newspaper endorsed John McCain in this race, but in that endorsement, you say Mitt Romney has the best understanding of the auto industry because of his roots in Michigan. Why did you finally lean then toward McCain?
Because we believe that this campaign is bigger than just economic issues and just the automotive industry. Our thought is that this is still a very dangerous world. And right now we're focused on our pocketbooks when we ought to have our heads up looking out at the world and the dangers it presents. McCain's the best person to navigate those waters.
Nolan, stick with us. Nolan Finley is editorial page editor for the Detroit News. We'll be back with him after just a quick break. And later in the broadcast, remembering Sir Edmund Hillary. Here and now. We're back with Nolan Finley, editorial page editor at the Detroit News. We're talking with him about the presidential contest in Michigan ahead of Tuesday's primary. Nolan, it's still a very crowded field, as you know, among the Republicans. And I'm wondering if you see anything, did you see anything last night in the debate that brought one particular candidate into the forefront?
Well, they're clearly focused on Michigan. We talked about the exchange and McCain on the automotive industry, and they also talked economic issues. Michigan is 5 years ahead of the rest of the nation in its concerns. We've been dealing with slow growth and recession for 5 years or more now, and the nation's finally catching up with us. What's interesting here is that Mike Huckabee sees an opportunity in Michigan. He rearranged his schedule to spend more time here and more money here. I'm right now at an event where he's speaking about economic issues, and it truly is a three-man race here that could go any direction.
Let's hear from Mike Huckabee. You bring him up. Third in New Hampshire, his big win in Iowa, of course. Here's an ad he's running in Michigan now.
We're losing manufacturing jobs. Homeowners face a credit crisis. High fuel costs are spiraling, and families are hurting. I cut taxes, built highways, reformed health care and education, and achieved record job growth. I'm Mike Huckabee, and I approve this message because I believe most Americans want their next president to remind them of the guy they work with, not the guy who laid them off.
That's a line that he's used before, as you know, Nolan, a shot at Mitt Romney from Romney's days as a venture capitalist. Are these the kind of ads that Huckabee's running now? Are they registering with Michigan voters?
Well, Michigan has always been receptive to a populist message, and perhaps now more than any other time, given the conditions here. There is also a very strong evangelical voting bloc in Michigan. It could be up to one-third of true Republican voters in this state. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a message that will resonate. Now, the factor that has to be considered in Michigan is that there's no Democratic primary for all practical purposes. So the independent voters are looking for some place to go. And right now, all indications are that they're going to McCain.
Hmm. Back to Mitt Romney for a moment. He's pulled his ads in South Carolina and Florida to concentrate more on Michigan. Is Michigan a must-win for him after his showings in Iowa and New Hampshire?
I don't know if it's a must-win in terms of he'll be gone after Michigan, but he certainly could use a win here. This is his home state. His father was a very popular governor here. He has led here in most of the polls throughout the year. And, yeah, he needs to make a strong showing here. But I'm not sure a strong second-place finish in Michigan would finish him off. I think he's got the resources to go on to South Carolina and to go on to Florida and Super Tuesday. If the race is still as ill-defined as it is today, I expect he'll be there on Super Tuesday.
All right, on to the Democrats now for a moment. Remind us, Nolan, why Hillary Clinton is the only major Democrat on the ballot in Michigan on Tuesday.
Well, New Hampshire threatened these Democratic candidates that if they campaigned in Michigan, if they put their names on the ballot in Michigan, they would be punished. As it turns out, they didn't punish Hillary Clinton. But these candidates boycotted the state. She's on the ballot here, but has pledged not to campaign here. We haven't seen her. And I think, you know, they have to be, that Obama and Edwards have to really be reconsidering that decision, regretting that decision, because this would have been an opportunity, particularly for Obama, to check the momentum Clinton gained in New Hampshire.
So is there some sort of effort on the behalf of Obama and his supporters for some sort of a write-in campaign at all?
But they can't write in because neither Obama nor Edwards registered as a write-in candidate. So if someone writes in their name, the ballot is spoiled. The effort is to come in and vote uncommitted. Well, it's hard for me to believe a whole lot of people are going to get excited on Election Day to get out in the cold and pull the lever for uncommitted.
Right.
But that's their only option if they're an anti-Clinton voter.
So it looks like Michigan's effort to get a head start on the process and influence the nomination process, if you will, backfired to some extent.
Only on the Democratic side. I think we're getting a lot of tension now on the Republican side. And what happens in Michigan will clarify this race. I think it was a very good decision on the Republican side because they're going to be a major player. Had we waited to February 5th, it would have been over, perhaps. And I think it's good for the process to have a state other than Iowa and New Hampshire weighing in before it goes to Super Tuesday. Same with Florida. I think both of those states are doing a good service to the political process.
Mm. You mentioned the independent vote a little earlier. Democrats and independents boosted John McCain in Michigan in 2000. You mentioned independents are leaning toward McCain again. This time around, what about Rudy Giuliani and Fred Thompson appealing to those groups?
Well, they haven't campaigned here. I mean, Giuliani has this Super Tuesday strategy. Probably a mistake. He polled very well here and then disappeared from Michigan. And now, you know, he's showing up really insignificant. I'd be surprised if he beats Ron Paul. Thompson, you know, hasn't really campaigned anywhere. We haven't seen him. He doesn't have an organization here. I don't know what to say about him.
Finally, Nolan, you wrote a piece recently about some of the strange things that Michigan voters have done in their primaries in the past. Remind us of some of that history, will you?
Well, yeah, that's why all the punditry in Michigan is pretty well useless. Back in 72, they went for George Wallace. They went for Jesse Jackson. They went for McCain last time when, you know, Bush was supposedly the strongest candidate here. This was one of the strongest states. So anything in a primary election, anything can happen in Michigan. I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if Ron Paul finished on top of this thing.
You're kidding.
Well, I say that facetiously, but you shouldn't be shocked. You shouldn't be shocked by whatever happens in Michigan. It's a quirky place in terms of primary voting. And who knows? If the Democrats all rush in and make mischief, anything can happen.
Michigan, of course, voted Democrat in the last four general elections, so there you go.
It did.
Nolan Finley is the editorial page editor of the Detroit News. Nolan, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Jay.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave us a message at 1-617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And this note about some of the stories in the works for next week, we have the backstory of Apple's iPhone, how it got ugly, and what makes a good film score. We'll get a lesson about what works and what does not. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Robin Young. That's next week on Here and Now. We'll be right back. Responding to a barrage of bad economic news, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke yesterday issued his strongest statement yet, saying that the Fed would cut interest rates as necessary to shore up the economy. The weakening economy has started a debate among experts and lawmakers about what, if anything, Washington should be doing. And the economy is becoming a factor in presidential politics. Here's Republican candidate Congressman Ron Paul in last night's presidential debate.
I believe we're in a recession. I think it's going to get a lot worse. But you have to understand that overstimulation in an economy by artificially low interest rates by the Federal Reserve is the source of the recession. If you do the wrong thing, it's going to last for a long time.
Among the reports this week that prompted the Fed chair to act, consumer confidence fell to an all-time low about worries on jobs, energy bills, and home foreclosures. The growth in holiday sales was the weakest in 5 years. The Labor Department reported a sharp jump in unemployment, and the two-year housing slump is showing no signs of easing. So now we check in with Edmund Andrews, business reporter for The New York Times. Edmund, great to have you with us.
Glad to join you.
So we started this week with President Bush acknowledging that the economy is hitting a hard stretch, and the Fed chair confirmed that yesterday. Are we already in a recession? Does that label even matter now?
We don't know yet. One of the things about recessions is you really never know you're in one until a few months after you're in them, and the official declaration of one comes even later than that. There are a few forecasters out there who believe we indeed have entered a recession already. Goldman Sachs issued a report earlier this week essentially saying that the downturn has begun. But it's a little hard to tell at this point. There's no question that growth has slowed very sharply, probably to a crawl. I have to say that that is what Fed officials were kind of expecting, you know, as long as a couple of months ago, that the last quarter would be of 2007 would be weak, but they didn't think it was going to go negative, that the economy would actually contract.
There seems to be a bit of good news today. Countrywide Financial, the mortgage lending giant that's been particularly hard hit by losses from subprime lending, looks like they're going to be acquired by Bank of America. Financial markets seem to be happy about the deal. What do you make of it, Ed?
Well, it's good for Countrywide, and it's probably good that we don't have a major lending institution become crippled. But, you know, what we're seeing here, obviously, is the biggest mortgage lender last year in such a debilitated state that it needs to be rescued. And it was rescued for a pretty small price, I would add. So it is a sign of just how serious the troubles are in the mortgage and banking sector. Mm.
Most analysts are now expecting that the Fed will lower the benchmark rate as much as a half a percentage point when it meets again at the end of the month. Is it true that low interest rates to some extent got us into economic trouble in the first place? No, especially with the housing crisis?
Well, you know, Ron Paul made that point, and there's a lot of truth to that. The housing bubble, if it wasn't caused by the Fed's slashing of low interest rates and after 2001, it was certainly the bubble was certainly exacerbated by that policy. We cut rates to very, very low levels in 2001 and kept them there through the middle of 2004. And there are quite a few economists, even some Fed officials, have said, you know, that probably did aggravate the problem and encourage the excesses, not only in housing speculation, but in mortgage lending practices.
There is growing pressure now on Congress, as you know, and the White House to do something about the economy. Is there anything like a consensus shaping up on what the federal government should do?
Well, I would not be at all surprised if there is if there's a rough agreement that some kind of a tax rebate broadly issued would be desirable. A lot of Democrats are sort of talking in the direction of a targeted and temporary tax cut or rebate that would be aimed at lower and middle income families. The Bush administration has been a lot quieter about what it wants to do. President Bush has signaled that he's thinking about a stimulus, and the Treasury Department is busy at work trying to figure out the options. Count on them to look to something in the tax cut arena. Their pattern has been, though, that they don't like things that smack of fine-tuning the economy. What they like are permanent tax cuts, which they say ultimately have more effect. Extending the president's tax cuts from 01 and 03 remains, you know, their real top priority, but that isn't going to do much to stimulate the economy right now.
There are a lot of differences as far as the answers as what to do about the economy. Differences fall certainly between the Democrats and Republicans.
Oh, yeah, there are a lot of differences. You can count on the Democrats, A, to want to focus much more closely on benefits flowing to low- and middle-income people. And there's an economic argument for that, by the way, which is that higher-income people, they will save at least a part of what they get. People who are really strapped are the ones who are going to spend all that money immediately, and that's what gives you your stimulus effect. The other conflict that is very likely is that the Democrats will want to incorporate some kind of spending programs, too. Maybe, you know, accelerated work on highways, bridges, and other kinds of infrastructure. And, you know, Bush is likely to fight anything that runs over his self-defined limits on spending growth.
What about the role of the Federal Reserve in all this, Ed? Ben Bernanke stepped into some pretty big shoes taking over from Alan Greenspan, and there's been persistent criticism of him of late that he hasn't been doing enough. What's your take?
I really don't have that take on him. There's a legitimate criticism to be made that in August, when the credit markets were seizing up in panic because of subprime loans, we had clearly a systemic problem on our hands. The Fed was very reluctant to move. Initially, they didn't cut the benchmark interest rate at their August meeting, but then were kind of forced to turn around, and a week later took an emergency measure of cutting the interest rate on emergency borrowing through the discount window. It's a partial measure, not nearly as potent as cutting the federal funds rate. You can argue that they moved a little too slowly and a little too cautiously, but the general pattern historically is that Wall Street in times of trouble pushes for rate cuts a lot harder and a lot earlier than the Fed. And the Fed has good reasons to not jump the gun, not show signs of panic. For one thing, you don't know often whether you really are headed to a downturn, and a false step toward cutting interest rates can have two bad effects. One is it can be inflationary, and the other thing is it can undermine confidence in the Fed if you have to reverse course a few months later because you were wrong.
Edmund Andrews is the economics reporter for The New York Times. Ed, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Before we go today, a conversation with actor Peter Fonda. You're listening to Here and Now. The New Zealand farmer-turned-mountaineer who became the first person to stand on the summit of Mount Everest has died. Sir Edmund Hillary, who made his now legendary climb in 1953, long before the advent of Gore-Tex, ice goggles, and flex-framed backpacks, described what he saw from the top as the whole world around us, spread out like a giant relief map. Sir Edmund Hillary was 88 years old. Mountaineer David Roberts has written extensively about Everest, including his acclaimed book, On the Ridge Between Life and Death. He interviewed Sir Edmund Hillary in 2003 for a National Geographic article on the 50th anniversary of the expedition. David, welcome to you.
Thank you.
What do you remember most about your interview with Sir Edmund Hillary?
Well, I think there was one especially poignant detail that hasn't been widely broadcast. Sir Edmund told me that after he and Tenzing reached the summit in 1953, he just naturally assumed Everest would never again be climbed. Hmm. And that, you know, it had been done. Why would anybody else want to do it? And, of course, he could never have imagined the circus, as it's called. Hmm. 530 people reached the summit last year, for instance.
Exactly.
So he didn't exactly have a crystal ball about that.
Well, take us back for a moment to that time in the 1950s. What did Everest represent for mountaineers back then, and how did the public view it, really?
Well, it was a big deal because there had been 8 or 9 expeditions starting in 1921 attempting it. And several climbers got to within 1,000 feet of the summit, but nobody had made it. So, after all, it's the highest point in the world. It was often called the Third Pole, the North and South Poles having been reached supposedly four decades earlier. Mm. So it was a really an ultimate final achievement.
And how significant was that feat? Why did he succeed where others before him had not?
Well, in a sense, he was lucky. He was not even on the first summit team. Two other guys, Charles Evans and Tom Bourdillon, made the first attempt and had to turn back partly because their oxygen equipment didn't work. They came very close. The year before, a Swiss and Tenzing himself had reached only 800 feet below the summit. So the luck of the draw put Hillary and Tenzing together on May 29th, 1953, and they made that last little bit. It was also inspired climbing, especially the so-called Hillary Step.
Yeah, the very last piece of the mountain, right?
The last technical stretch.
Yeah. Today, mountaineering is such a huge industry, and the array of technical gear alone is staggering. And I want you to compare for us what Hillary used to make his ascent on Everest with what mountaineers are using today.
Well, it's not comparable at all. It's not only the equipment, which has been revolutionized. It's the, in a sense, the mountain has been trivialized by the fact that so many people go there and that ropes are fixed from the bottom to the top. When Hillary was leading that last section, nobody had ever been there. He had no aids like fixed ropes. He had no idea how hard it would be, and no one in support. It was basically him and Tenzing, and they had to take care of each other's lives. Mm. So it was just incommensurable. Mm.
Tell us a little bit about Sir Edmund Hillary's later achievements after he climbed Everest.
He didn't climb a lot more. He did do some marathon expeditions like the motorized traverse of Antarctica with Sir Vivian Fuchs in, I think, 1957. But the great thing that Hillary did was that he poured his energy and his fame into building a series of schools, hospitals, and medical clinics in Nepal for the Sherpa people. Mm-hmm. And this was not some grandstanding publicity thing. It was simply giving back to the people who he knew it so much in the British success on Everest. Mm. And he kept this up for decades. It's truly an altruistic and heroic effort, and he deserves full credit for that. He stayed a modest and humble man his whole life, which is incredible considering he's the most famous mountaineer in history. Mm.
David Roberts, thanks so much for your thoughts and your insight and remembrances of Sir Edmund Hillary. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Peter Fonda, Here and Now. Though he's from a famous acting family, Peter Fonda came into his own as the star, producer, and co-writer of 1969's Easy Rider. His anti-hero who hopped on a motorcycle in search of America still has many fans today. Robin Young found that out when she attended a screening of Fonda's latest film, 310 to Yuma, which has just been released on DVD. The film stars Russell Crowe as Ben Wade, head of an outlaw gang. He's captured and must be put on the 310 to Yuma train to be tried. Christian Bale is Dan Evans. He agrees to be one of the men charged with getting Wade on that train, despite the constant danger posed by Wade's gang. Peter Fonda plays Byron McElroy, a Pinkerton detective who's trying to help him. As the film opens, Byron is guarding a stagecoach, which Ben Wade brutally attacks, pausing only to say hello.
Byron McElroy. Bend your hair to an all gray, Byron.
Doc, you gotta help Ben Wade.
Well, would you look at all this? Y'all spared no expense this time, Byron. I gotta say, though, it's probably cheaper just to let me rob the damn thing.
Robin Young spoke to Peter Fonda about his role in 310 to Yuma.
I play a bounty hunter, and there's some backstory between me and Ben Wade.
Right, the outlaw.
Yeah, and one imagines that's because I probably hunted him down while I was a bounty hunter before I was under hire to the Pinkerton Agency.
As you say, it's better than playing a character from the current cowboy mythology. What do you mean by that? Do you think we've mythologized?
Well, we have, in a way. The West is, the Western is our mythological Ulysses or some of those great Greek dramas. And they carry that in the American Western. That carries that mythology forward. Our good and bad, our semi-good and bad, our not-so-white hat and not-so-black hat. My father made a movie called Oxbow Incident. Mm-hmm. Now, that was all character-driven. Those characters had to come with the grips of their own own actions.
It's funny. I thought a lot of your dad while watching this movie. We think Henry Fonda when we think of Westerns movies like The Oxbow Incident, in which he plays a character trying to stop a hanging. My Darling Clementine, he's Marshall Wyatt Earp. I thought of him especially in watching your movie when watching the Christian Bale character. He's the good guy rancher trying to do the right thing. And I thought, you know, that would be the part your dad would play. But at a screening we saw, you took questions from the audience, and when people spoke of your dad, you said, wait a minute, what about Fort Apache?
Yeah.
which was the Western in which he played a really bad guy.
Colonel Thursday, yeah. I used that as a joke. Well, partly a joke. What was it like growing up as Henry Fonda's son? Have you ever seen Fort Apache?
I call it to your attention that in taking my daughter riding without bespeaking my permission, you have been guilty of behavior more consistent with that of an uncivilized Indian than an officer and a gentleman. If I have not made myself sufficiently clear, mister, I will add this. You will not again ride with my daughter. And for reasons which I feel it unnecessary to go into, you will avoid her company in the future.
We know, I mean, you've spoken of having sort of a tough relationship at times with your dad. Here he is, an American legend.
Yeah.
In fact, you've spoken of taking up motorcycle riding and maybe there being a direct line to Easy Rider through your rebellion against your dad. Is that, have I got that?
You know,
that
could have been it because I wrote the story in Toronto in September of 1967. And that could have had something with my desire to do that rebellious thing. I always wear dark glasses. I started when I was 13.
You're wearing them now.
Yeah, but it's because my dad, you take those glasses off. So I wore those glasses, you know, even when I didn't have to use them. Now I need to see with them. So well, it's got a practical application.
But so when you do a Western.
I can't wear the dark glasses.
No, but can you stop thinking about your dad?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's not a genetic thing.
Well, then is there something in all of us maybe that carries sort of a cowboy gene? Your co-star, Ben Foster, one of the seriously, psychotically bad guys in the gang.
And he's perfect in it.
He's terrific.
And he as a person is a sweet guy.
Well, but he said, you know, in his research, he found that these really bad guys were sort of the rock stars of their day, that they really dressed flamboyantly, and that they saw these killings, these, you know, coming into town to cause terror as sort of their own rock shows. And I was thinking almost the opposite, that for me the film was about seeing what it was like to be terrified of outlaws.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, applying it today, you know, I was thinking this must be what it feels like to be a neighborhood at the mercy of a gang, whether it's a city in New York or in Baghdad.
Right, good call. And it was supposed to be that way. In other Westerns, in the classic way, the bad guy comes down, you see everybody scuttling away and hiding in their shops and their
houses.
And
the sheriff comes out and shoots them.
Yeah. This is a bit different because the gang, Ben Wade's gang, is a really bad bunch.
That's Ben Wade they have up there.
What's he doing?
The railroad intends to put him on the 310 to Yuma and hang him. We will give you $200 cash dollars to any man who shoots any one of his captors.
Peter Fonda, there is a lot of shooting in 310 to Yuma. You get gut shot. At the screening we went to, someone expressed surprise that after your character, you know, gets shot like that, he can stand up and walk around. And your response was, have you ever been shot? And then you said, I have.
Yeah, well, a month shy of my 11th birthday, a very foolish act that happened to me. A bullet blew the tip off my liver, the top of my stomach, and landed in the middle of my left kidney. I died three times on the table, on the operating table. I lost so much blood, and the doctor came in where my maternal grandmother and my sister Jane were waiting. And he said, I'm sorry, Mrs. Seymour, there's nothing more we can do. And so 48 seconds, my sister Jane thought I was dead. And one of his assistants came out, no, we got his heart started again. Big shot of adrenaline. So well, that really did happen to me, and you don't stumble around.
Well, we want to be clear here. In real life, when, as you say, you took the shot, you've said it was an accident, but you shot yourself. It was your hands. And this was just 9 months after your mom committed suicide.
Yeah. And, of course, my whole family thought I was trying to commit suicide, but they forgot that they didn't tell me. I learned about that. Every 5 years, I learned something new. When I was 15, I learned that she died in a insane asylum. When I was 20, I learned she died in a insane asylum by suicide.
Oh, so you didn't
imagine?
Know.
No, I didn't know. So each time I had to rebury my mom. And then at 25, I found out by reading an interview that my sister Jane had given that she died from a suicide by cutting her throat from ear to ear. And yeah. So can you imagine learning that every 5 years I had to rebury my mother?
Wow. Well, it just...
How does that deal with 310, though?
There's a lot more in that scene now. I will actually, if I watch it again, watch it with a whole new, you know, of you having a gunshot wound.
Oh, on set, I said, okay, how many of you guys have been shot in the gut? You know, they're all kind of looking to the ground.
Yeah.
And I lifted out of my shirt where there's a big scar, and I said, I have.
It also says to me, no wonder, as a young man, you got on a motorcycle and rode across the country. I mean, who wouldn't want to just sort of digest all of this? And I just want to leave it on that note, because also at the screening, a young person got up, maybe doesn't know that much about Henry Fonda or Jane Fonda or any of these backstories.
Fonda.
Or Bridget, but none of these backstories you've just been telling us. What he said to you was, though, Easy Rider was your Western, and it still resonates with him. This was a young kid.
Right.
How did it feel to you to have, after a lot of people asking you about, and I've just done the same, Henry Fonda, to have someone say to you, your film is the one that resonates with him still today, a kid?
It's amazing. But as we were stepping out of the car here in front of the studio, I couldn't see the car, but I could hear, hey, Easy Rider. And that was... I wrote that when I was 27. We started the film on my 28th birthday. Yeah. And I'm 67 now. I'm still making films. But most of the time, the questions are about Easy Rider. I don't mind that.
Born to be wild. Born to be wild.
Actor Peter Fonda. His latest film, 310 to Yuma, is out on DVD this week. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Jane Clayson. Robin Young will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend. And join us again, Here and Now.